Monday, September 23rd, 2021. This is the Hermetic Hour. I'm your host, Pope Runyon. And tonight, we are reviewing Journey to the Castle, a book on witchcraft and paganism by Anne Finnan, and we will have the author on with us talking about this very important book, because this book, and I'll quote from the back cover, this book is one couple's journey into the underworld. The author sincerely hopes that her and her husband's experiences will serve to provide a warning to some and a solace to others who have engaged on similar journeys with less than desirable results. And finally, what the future holds for those with the courage and the honesty to embark on such a journey. Now, in the summer of 1982, two idealistic and naive California witches embarked on the quest to find the source of a tradition that had come down to them 7 years earlier, fragmented and distorted, from a teacher who had himself revived it in a manner of opportunity presenting itself, and that this was an opportunity to present itself to travel to England and explore the roots of the tradition. And they found that the roots did indeed grow deep into the soil that contained within some very, very tainted elements. Now, this book will enlighten a lot of American traditional witches. And one of the things that we want to get into in the beginning, make sure that that readers are informed about the makeup of American witchcraft. American witchcraft is broken into two. Now, of course, with the dyadic feminists, that was, we could say three distinct branches. Those following Gerald Gardner, the Gardnerians, and those following Robert Graves, the White Goddess, and that is the Clan of Tubal-Cain and 1734, and other American traditional groups that are lined up with them, and then, of course, you know, as I said, there's also the dyadic feminist witches, but we're not going to deal with them tonight. Anne, are you on with us?
I'm here, folks.
Okay, let's continue. Get this the American witchcraft perspective in everybody's mind, so they know what we're talking about. And when we get into the recounting the whole sequence of your journey to the castle. Now, a lot of the White Goddess branch of American traditional witchcraft, or British traditional witchcraft, actually, it goes back to Celtic mythology, but it also, Robert Graves was very eclectic in the White Goddess, and he connects the Celtic with the biblical, and this is why we have the Clan of Tubal-Cain. Tubal-Cain is actually a biblical character and also a Masonic character, and all of this figures in to the mix in the traditional witchcraft. And the person who inspired this was a British mystic by the name of Roy Bowers, who wrote under the name of Robert Cochrane in British Pagan Journals. And he claimed to be a hereditary witch, and for quite a while people believed him, and eventually it turned out that he really wasn't. He was a self-mythologizer. But Roy was nonetheless he was a poetic and romantic and poetic genius, and he created a shamanic native British, primarily derived from the White Goddess, a native British, very shamanic type of witchcraft using Celtic gods, this tradition was brought over to this country, over to America, by an American shamanic witch who Ann and I both knew rather well, perhaps too well. Anyway, Joe Wilson was in the Air Force over in England, and he met Roy Bowers, and they corresponded. And I don't know whether he ever met him personally. Ann, did Joe ever meet Roy personally?
No, he didn't. For one thing, Roy died in 1966, and Joe didn't get to England until 1971. There was a long gap there. He met several people that claimed to have known Roy, particularly Norman Giles and Tony Kelly and some of the other non-Gardnerian witches in that particular area. But the problem that Joe had, and if you recall, was that he ran seriously afoul of the Gardnerian establishment in London. It's a long story. I don't know whether you want to go into it or not, but basically he was there as an Air Force captain, I believe he was, and he was investigating.
No, he wasn't a captain.
He wasn't?
He was an enlisted man, and as I recall, it was a political kind of an issue.
He was investigating some subversive elements in the Air Force, and he came out publicly as a witch in the British press, the Gardnerian establishment, particularly Doreen Valiente and the London Coven, took exception to that and wanted nothing to do with him. And so he ended up having to associate with some of the outcasts of the British craft, which was even more profound than what we have here, in that you had the London intelligentsia, who were all Gardnerians, and then you had the outcasts and the shamans and the old style cunning men and the self-appointed wizards that were in the countryside, Norman Giles being one of them. And in the corpus of letters that we inherited from Mar Schaefer was included several letters that he had written to Norman regarding gypsy magic and that kind of thing.
Let me interrupt you and get something straight, because there are a lot of people in this country who think that Joe actually had letters written to him by Roy Bowers.
That's true. He did.
So he was, Joe was in England while Roy was still alive.
Oh, yes, but he never met him personally.
Yeah. He had these letters,
Yes, he did. He had answered an advertisement Joe had written an advert in some British newsletter about wanting to correspond with a British traditional witch, i.e. somebody who wasn't Gardnerian. And Roy decided he would answer the advert, and he and Joe had probably about a year-long correspondence with many letters back and forth, and which ended abruptly at his death in June of 1966. So there was an actual correspondence between Roy and Joe. But when Joe went to England, he ended up with the Norman Giles letters, which was something that was an additional part of the corpus.
But those letters that he got from Roy, they form the basis for this Order of 1734. And apparently 1734 was something, even though Roy never codified it as an order. It was a code in one of his letters. I recall that because I've read the transcript too. But at the present time on the internet, if you check this out on the internet, what is being claimed is that Mara Schaefer burned up all these letters, and Joe had to recreate them from memory.
That was Joe. What originally had happened was Joe and Mara split in 1974, I believe, and Joe burned the letters. The only reason we have them at all is that Mara kept a Xerox copy of them, and we know this because when she went to England in 76, I believe, 75 or 76, we kept her filing cabinet in our home because she didn't have a place to stay at the time. And so we kept her filing cabinet and some of her other things, and we had permission from her to copy whatever was in there. So we copied the photocopies that she had made of the Bowers letters, and we posted them on our website, which made a lot of people very upset because they were similar to what Joe had, but Joe had added a few things that weren't in the original letters, which we found it. Whoever burned the letters, it wasn't Mara. And the only reason we have them at all is that she gave them to us.
Yeah, I know. I have a complete file of them too. You know, anyway, that to claim that if you Google Order of 1734, you're going to come up with a version of all those papers.
Most of them are accurate. They were retyped. I suspect that after Joe and Mara split, Joe had a problem with drinking, and he would get drunk and he would do stupid things. He burned the letters when he was drunk. The only reason he has them on his website is we gave him copies. Because he worked with the Roebuck for a couple of years in between the time that he and Mara split up and the time that Joey was his third wife, right? He had several. But between the time that Mara left and Joey came along, there was about a couple of years in there, and we gave him copies of his own letters.
Yeah.
And that's the only reason he has them or had them on his website, because he retyped them, and they are accurate, except that he added a few things that weren't in the originals, which we pointed out to people, and we've gotten into a lot of trouble. because we can point out, which was one of the reasons why they didn't like the fact that we posted the original letters on our website, is the fact that there were additions that Joe made that weren't in the originals.
Yeah.
So
one of the reasons why you got in trouble, and I think that some people listening to us that don't really know that much about this situation, one of the reasons why you got in trouble by publishing these is because Joe Wilson, along with his friend and fellow Ed was an Air Force officer and Joe was an Air Force enlisted man, but Ed Fitch and Joe Wilson, those two Air Force men over in England, they are the guys who brought witchcraft, British witchcraft, back to this country. And Joe Wilson was a kind of a Johnny Appleseed. He spread that 1734 tradition that he launched. That's all over the place. I ran into it in Georgia.
Yes.
I ran into it. I ran into it in Pennsylvania. I ran into it all over the place. So that's the reason why anybody, like you and I, suppose if we did a 17, well, we may the OTA may get in trouble just for doing this program with you, because the 1734 people that are listening, or if they're not listening, somebody will tell them about it, and they will be. They'll go to the archives and listen to it, and we're liable to get a lot of flack. Well, that's fine.
That's the truth. And the problem that you had with Joe was that, like a lot of other people in spreading information about that time, he didn't give any attributions to the material he was giving out. There was no indication that the letters were from Roy, that he mixed a lot of the Bowers material in with his own material. He didn't give any attributions. He mixed in a lot of other people's material that he visited during his time in England. Ruth Winoan, for example, and Plant Bran, he had a lot of her information that he just mixed in to the mix. We have a draft, and you do too, of course, because you have the same material we do, of a book that he was putting together on. It was a whole bunch of other people's stuff thrown into the cauldron there, and he was going to stir it all up and serve it up as a book, and that's okay. I mean, that's fine. But the problem is, you have a lot of people who are calling themselves 1734 who have absolutely no idea where the information came from and under what circumstances, and they get all bent out of shape because they were probably, this is three generations of covens by this time. And each coven has its own story of where their material came from, and they're all different, and they're all divergent, and there's no consistency as to what the tradition, where it came from, and what it actually is. Most of the 1734 covens we have come across, just as an aside, tend to be kind of Wiccan covens with the 1734 material kind of ladled on, and because there was no ritual structure that Roy had, there was no way of practicing it. And one of the things that
let me slow you down here. Any further with this, let's give our listeners a little idea of what 1734 witchcraft was and what it was kind of like. It was very shamanic, and Bowers And one of the points you make it constantly in your book, The Journey to the Castle, is the shamanic aspect of this this Robert Graves derived, this Robert Graves derived witchcraft. Mm-hmm. You should be aware that 1734 witchcraft is kind of like Monty Python without humor. It's a medieval. It's Monty Python without no laughter, and mm-hmm. The idea of the old guy asking you what's your favorite color, that's almost a 1734 kind of thing, and we used to. In doing rituals, we used to dig a moat. That was the magic circle. It was a castle.
Absolutely,
moat.
Absolutely, yeah.
And the castle was the other world. You were entering the dimension of the gods by crossing the moat, and then we had the quarters and the whole thing was The 1734 was very medieval, and that's why I'm saying that's why so many people in the Society for Creative Anachronism were, of course, also involved in 1734.
Yeah.
Anyway, yes, and the White Goddess, of course, is like the Bible for traditional British witchcraft. Now, you and Dave founded the Coven of the Roebuck based on growing out of 1734 and what you yourselves derived from the White Goddess and whatever, and that's where the Roebuck you got started with the Roebuck,
uh-huh.
And then, in 1982, the two of you set forth on a quest to go to England and actually meet all these old guys that had known Roy, and of course that's primarily Bill Gray
John Jones.
And so you went over to England and to meet all these people, including Basil Wilby and the rest of them, and actually visit the sacred sites and like I said in the abstract, walk the ley lines and visit the castles and actually get to the root of it. Now, and that's what you did. That's what you detail in this book and give the impressions and everything. And so you want to talk about your adventures in merry old England.
Well, it actually ends up being several trips. The first one was in 1982, and we had gone there with the we had no idea who we were going to meet. Mara Schaefer had gone there some years before that and had met Norman Giles of the Norman Letters in the corpus and was not impressed with him. We didn't feel that was a useful person to meet. We ended up going to see Bill Gray, of all people. And the reason why we went to see Bill Gray was because of his book, The Rollright Ritual, which was something that we had read years ago that had really not a lot of connection with his Kabbalistic stuff that he had been writing. He was a ceremonial magician and a Kabbalist and and all this. And this was something totally different. And we wanted to talk to him about it. And as it turned out, the book was inspired by and probably co-authored by Roy Bowers. Apparently, Bill and Roy had gone out to the Rollwrights and had done some scrying and what have you on. And they came up with this Dweller of the Threshold ritual that you do to gain entrance to the realm of the old ones, realm of the ancestors. And we had no idea at the time that he even knew Roy. And he not only told us the whole story of how Roy died and all the rest of it, but he produced two things that we hadn't expected. One was a pack of letters that he had gotten from Roy over the years, that he apparently his place over many years. And he used that information as a chapter in one of his Western Inner Mysteries books called Paganistic Principles. And he had them and wanted to know if we wanted copies of them. And of course, yes. So we made copies and brought them back. The only stipulation that he made was that we not give them out or publish them until he was gone, because there was some very personal stuff in there about his mother and information for horoscope charts and things like that.
Yeah.
So we honored that, and that was fine. And he also produced a red cord, a red silk cord that he claimed was Roy's cord that they used to wear the cord around the neck in ritual. Mm-hmm. And it apparently had 8 knots in it, and they had, he and a protege of his had done a ritual right after Roy had died where they untied the knots in order to set his soul free. And he produced this cord and gave it to us. And we looked at it and, you know, oohed and aahed and, you know, very reverently gave it back. And he said, "Nope, keep it. It's yours now." And gave it to Dave.
Now, that's almost a dispensation
It was absolutely, you know, we were floored because we didn't even know the thing existed. And he showed it to us and told us the story. And we were very appreciative. And then when we tried to give it back, he wouldn't take it back. So then we had this thing.
Let me ask you a question while we're on this subject now. There was a book published. I can't remember whether the title was The Poison Chalice or I know Chalice was in the title about Roy's death.
The Poison Chalice.
Now, apparently that book was a romanticized version of Roy's death. He actually supposedly, according to what you've been telling us, what you tell us in the journey into the castle, that mm-hmm. Roy's death was suicide, but it was not magical suicide.
The Poison Chalice actually was an essay that was written some years later, actually detailing how he died. They went into medical records and newspaper clippings of the time and all of that. The myth of Roy dying in the circle surrounded by his people came from Norman Giles, and that was what Norman told to Joe. The Poison Chalice was actually almost a forensic examination of, like I said, medical records and newspaper clippings and whatever of how Roy actually died, and that's how we we learned that he had been found wrapped up in a sleeping bag after taking an overdose of belladonna and librium, and that coincided
yeah.
with what Bill Gray, but what John Jones told us
yeah.
is in terms of
yeah.
how Roy had died. There was apparently a breakup with his wife, and
yeah.
he was despondent about her walking out and taking his son
yeah.
with her, and
yeah.
and that he had done all of this. The question arose whether this was a deliberate suicide or whether this was just, a cry for help, wanting her attention and wanting her to come back to him because, you know, he was ill and all this. So it really was never clear and wasn't clear to either Roy or to either Bill or John as to whether this was a deliberate suicide or not. But the story of him taking the poison chalice in a circle and forbidding all of his people from calling the police until he had already passed was something that Norman told to Joe, and John in particular was very, very affronted with the whole idea that somebody was spreading this. He and Roy had been close, and he had seen Roy only a few days before Roy's death, and really didn't like the fact that somebody was spreading this story. And that was one of the reasons why we wanted to set the record straight. So,
two questions about this. Number one, there'd been some mumblings and mutterings about Roy Bowers using Amanita and using it in a ritual instance. Have you ever run across anything like that in any of your investigation?
Not Amanita. He used belladonna, though. I mean,
this is something
they used belladonna, and they had a recipe for it. I don't know the exact proportions. We made some, but we never had the nerve to try it. Basically, steeping the belladonna root in alcohol, and
mm-hmm.
putting it in. You know, in the chalice during the ritual, like I said, we never did it, and there was a recipe, but John wouldn't tell us, and I don't blame him. So, belladonna was the only one that only there were other milder. Things that he used. For example, he used a lot of nutmeg. Nutmeg has a mild hallucinogenic property to it,
I tried that one time, and I came to the conclusion that it was about as effective as banana peels. You know,
I think a lot of that was suggestion. You know, and. Yeah, and you have this cup, and you're going to drink it, and you're going to have visions, and so you drink. You know, you could have it could have been plain water, and you'd still have visions. But that was the only mind altering substance that we knew of that he used, and again, we never tried it because for one thing, belladonna is. Anything like that is very touchy, even if you have a recipe, because you know it depends on how old the plant is and where it's grown, and would belladonna in California be the same kind of plant as belladonna in England, and so you know that's something you don't want to mess with, and we we decided that we wouldn't use it. But he used the mushroom, fly agaric mushroom, as kind of a symbol of a lot of things. But then so did everybody else over there. I mean, you had even now you have little gnomes sitting on top of a red cap mushroom with white spots on it. I mean, this is a folk meme. And he used that like a lot of other British, you know, folklorists would use that he certainly knew what it was and how it was used, but again these are things that even when you know what you're doing, you don't mess with, particularly if you have a group of people that you want to stay alive. It's, for you know,
you're
have
responsible
a problem with.
Yeah, you're responsible for them, and
absolutely.
And actually that wasn't why I asked the question. I didn't want to get into get really into that too much, because 1734 did not have that kind of tradition. Joe's problem was that he discovered the Great American College Boys Secret. Great American College Boys Secret that all fraternities college fraternities know is this: you really can get drunk on 3.2 beer, but you just have to work at it.
Yeah.
And that brings up to the other question. Joe's beer drinking brings up the other question. Did Roy Bowers ever use or recommend a witch's cradle?
Not that we knew of. There is something called a witch's cradle that was where you had a piece of string and you wound it between your fingers, and you could make it into a ladder, or a crow foot. We did that when we were kids. I learned how to do that back in grade school.
Yeah.
It was where you'd have a loop, and then one finger would go under the other finger, and you'd weave either a ladder a crow's foot, and that was all we knew about.
I'm familiar with that one. But what I'm talking about is the witch's cradle, where you hang somebody upside down.
We never heard anything about Roy doing anything like that.
Well,
not
Joe,
from Joe, not from John.
I've got do you mind me recounting the infamous incident with Joe initiating Brian and the witch's cradle?
Well, you can if you want, but let's make it clear that one of the tasks
1734 and Roy Bowers had nothing to do with the witch's cradle. That was
No. That was Joe's interpretation of. See, Joe picked up an awful lot of lore and bits and pieces from people like Tony Kelly and all that, and so. The problem that we had originally was how much of the 1734 tradition that we learned was Joe's invention, and how much of it was from Roy. And the witch's hanging somebody from the witch's cradle was nothing that Roy or John or Bill Gray did. That was strictly a Joe Wilson invention. And as far as I know, Byron was the only guy that they did that to.
Well, after what almost happened to Byron, I can understand why they didn't do it again. But we recounted that story many times. In fact, we even did, when we had the memorial to Joe Wilson at Raven's Flight, and that was back when Joe died. I don't know whether you were there when we did it, but we actually replicated the whole scene.
That was not a standard initiation practice, and it wasn't done to us, and it wasn't done to you, and it wasn't done to Mara, and it wasn't done to any of the other members of the circle at the time. It was done to Byron because that was Joe's practical joke on Byron for reasons that have nothing to do with anything other than Byron being Byron. And Joe wanting to Joe had a streak that Roy shared, and I think this is significant to bring out in that he was a trickster. He liked to pull the leg of people that for the secrets of the universe. And Roy did the same thing. He did the same thing to Justine Glass when she was writing that book. He ladled on all sorts of rubbish that she put in the book. He did it because he wanted to play a joke on the American writer. And that's what happened to us with John. There was an awful lot of stuff that we were given over the years that was John's own way of poking, you know, being a trickster and playing a joke on a naive seeker, and that was probably why he did it, and it had nothing to do with anything that we found out later that the old group did. They did some weird stuff, but they didn't do that.
The classic example of that is Crowley and Gerald York telling Dion Fortune to if she really wanted to have a vision to strip naked and rub herself all over with a dead mackerel.
It's on that same level, and
apparently she did it and told them that she didn't get anything, and the two of them just laughed at her because they just wanted to see if she'd be naive enough to do it.
Ed used to do that the egg in the Jewish cemetery trick that he'd pull on people.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a fine old tradition of asking a naive person to do something so terribly stupid that you expect them to say, "Oh, come on," and then when they actually do it, it's a big joke, which in our case ended up being a big joke that we innocently promulgated in our group, and it caused all sorts of problems. So that's ha ha funny to the guys that are doing it, but as we found out in the whole Byron Baker case, it could have turned out to be very tragic, and sometimes the joke goes south, and it's not a pretty sight.
The business with Byron and the witch's cradle could have been a tragedy, but like so many things, so many magical adventures, because it didn't become a tragedy, we can all chuckle over it. But to tell you the truth, because it's kind of politically incorrect right now, so I'm not going to recount the whole thing. We'll have to wait for me to write my book, like Journey to the Castle, which after you have written this wonderful book, I am impelled to go back to go back and finish the Wizard of Wa, and that's the one that I'm writing about my adventures.
Okay.
I figured out that LA could be worked into a logo very much like Oz, and you know, yeah. And so that's what I'm going to call mine, the Wizard of Wa. Anyway, let's get back to yours. You're walking the old straight track, walking the ley lines, exploring Norfolk. I thought this was wonderful. You're going out and actually experiencing these sacred sites in England. They were the ones we were reading about in the view over Atlantis and the old straight track, all those books that we were all reading, and you actually went over there and actually did it. Tell us about that, some of the experiences you had.
Well, one of the big things that we came away with is that this may sound odd to your listeners, but or maybe not. There are forces that guard these places, and there are certain times that they allow people in, and certain people they allow in. If you're going to go to, you know, there are people that go to Stonehenge that search for enlightenment and they don't find it. But it's one of these things where if you approach it in the right frame of mind and you approach it at the right time and you approach it in the spirit of honest seeking, then sometimes the gates open and you have experiences. One of the reasons I put in the whole idea of the Rowright ritual, where you stand at the gate and you answer questions and you present yourself as to the old ones, and you basically give an offering, not just yourself, but you give an actual, you pay the coin. One of the things we did at the Rowrights was to, we had a special coin. I think it was a half dollar that had some silver in it. So we consecrated that in our temple before we went over there, and we buried it in the middle of the circle. And we basically said, this is our token. And we've come halfway across the globe to stand here and present our case. And here is our offering. Here is our token. And that gates opened up for us. Not always what we expected, of course, but they opened up. We ended up being led to people that we needed to talk to at a particular point in time, and things just kind of clicked into place. But if we had just been, you know, an old had gone to Stonehenge and expected, you know, the earth to move and the light from heaven to come down and enlighten them, no, it didn't happen that way. And Americans have a problem with that. Not all, but most Americans who go to sacred sites say, okay, here I am, you lucky people. Now open the gates for me and enlighten me. And to be honest, one of the reasons why you have people like Jesse Bell, like Lady Sheba, who notoriously published the Gardnerian Book of Shadows as her secret Book of Shadows from her grandmother, or whatever the story was, and got in trouble. That's what happened. And the British, a lot of the British old ones, are very weary of Americans going over there and taking their sacred thing and then coming back to America and making a buck off of it. And that happened frequently, notoriously frequently. So it's a matter of you petition the old ones, the ancient ones, the forces that guard such places, and if they find you worthy, then they take you where you need to go. If they don't, they don't, and that's the end of that. You know, it's a matter of being accepted by the ancient forces that guard these places. And we worked very long and hard and sacrificed to go over there and stand at the gate and make our petition. And we were accepted. We might not have been. It could very well have been that we weren't accepted. We ended up with Mara Schaefer and Norman Giles I told you that story, didn't I? That was what happened when Mara met Norman Giles. Did I tell you that story?
Well, why don't we recount it for our listeners right now?
Okay, basically, Norman Giles was the Norman of the Norman letters, the letters to Norman in the corpus, if anybody's familiar with that. And she found Norman, who lived in a little cottage out in the boonies with his mother and a middle-aged, you know, man. And she found him and went to visit him. And his thing was photographing fairies. And what he would do is he'd get an attractive young lady to wear short and go tromping through the grass, and he would take photographs of the fairies that would be attracted to her legs. And after a session of this, Mara figured out that she was being had, and she decided that Norman didn't know what as much as he claimed to know about what Roy was doing, and so she went on to other things. We found out later when we were discussing Norman, we ended up being hosted by a couple in Wales, and the lady of the pair been one of Norman's proteges, and they were the ones who hopped over the iron fence in the roll right rituals and got the kingstone, the capstone. I'm sorry, it wasn't the kingstone. No. It was the Whispering Knights. There was a capstone of it was a trilithon. It was it had a cromlech. Yeah. It had a capstone over it, and the capstone had fallen and had broken into pieces. And apparently what had happened was that they had snuck in there in the middle of the night and had vaulted over the railing, the cast iron railing that blocked it off from visitors, and had stolen a piece of the capstone. And it ended up in Norman's back garden or something. But it was that stone that he gave to Joe Wilson, who brought it back to California. And that was the stone that Joe was giving people pieces of to prove that they were, you know, initiates in 1734. But apparently Norman was notorious for being kind of an old cunning man and a con artist. And, he had been, I guess, engaged to a gypsy girl and had learned some gypsy lore from her. But as far as being any kind of traditional craft, no, he wasn't. He was an old cunning man. He was an old guy that would do love spells for the local people and trick them into thinking that he had the power to do all of this. And Rosina was telling us that he did this all the time. So again, this was a con that Joe Wilson fell for, and probably a deliberate con that he fell for. And he was told this whole fairy tale on how Roy died. This was from Norman, and this was a deliberate load of bullcrap that these old cunning men would dish out to naive Americans. And Joe
this
Wilson
very,
fell for it,
you know,
just
this,
like
this,
we did.
This is very, very similar to a Victorian age. Well, not quite. I think 1920s is better. There was another guy like this who was photographing fairies and publishing the fairy. And Harry Houdini supposedly investigated him. And,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Harry decided, because the children loved him so much, that Harry would not expose him. And so it's kind of a cute story. Whether it's true or not,
yeah,
I don't
yeah,
know. But
well, these guys were doing stuff like that, but whether this was something that he did frequently, or if this was just something he wanted to see how far Mara would go to gain whatever knowledge that she thought he had. I don't know, but the whole that was the one thing we found throughout all of that was this trickster energy, where these guys would try to fool you with something with some sort of con they thought that you would buy into, and then when you did, they'd laugh at you. And so, that you can say, well, that wasn't fair, but in some ways that's a kind of a like any trickster. It was an initiation test. It was are you for real, or do you just want some want something for nothing? You know, you wanna buy into the con and let me have my way with you. You know, we fell for it with John, and that was an object lesson, and we learned the lesson, and we tried not to blame him for it. The real problems came afterwards. When we were told that all of the hard work that we had done with John was that, oh, he was just funning you. He was just having you on, you know, that kind of thing. He wasn't the only one who did that. The plant brand people did that too. And that was something that the only one person that never did that, that we never heard that did that to anybody, that was always straight up with everybody, and that was Bill Gray.
Yeah.
We never heard
that
he had pulled this nonsense on anybody.
I corresponded with Bill Gray. I wish I still had those letters. Maybe I do. Maybe I have them somewhere deep down in my files. But I remember Bill Gray was really one of the most inspiring and one of the most sincere and genuine magicians, and he was that bridge between ceremonial magic and witchcraft. And also, we ought to mention while we're discussing this, you know, various versions of British witchcraft, Gardnerian witchcraft is primarily derived from Solomonic ceremonial magic.
Yes.
That Gardner
was an acolyte of Aleister Crowley. We have he got a charter from Crowley.
Not only that, he was a Solomonic ceremonial magician. And if you really want to understand the structure of Gardnerian witchcraft, you need to read his novel, High Magic Sade.
Absolutely.
I know we did a show. Those people who are interested in listening, dig into the archives of the Hermetic Hour, and we've got a two part show on High Magic Sade, and that's with Ed Finch along with us on that show. And of course, Ed Finch is the oldest living Gardnerian elder in this country, I believe, at this point. I think Ray Buckland's already passed away.
Yes, I think.
Hasn't he? Yeah.
He passed
five
years ago.
And Ed's still with us. And I hope he's listening tonight. Anyway, we're just about to the end of the hour. I would like to point out before we close down that John really did at least pose as the custodian of the clan of Tubal Cain. Whether or not he really was or not, he posed as the custodian, and he bestowed it on you and Dave. And then a few years later, he unbestowed it, and I think we ought to make that clear that you and Dave are the head of anything John was the custodian of. You are the head of it, and not the person you bestowed it on.
I wouldn't go quite that far. I think that one of the things that John had no intention of doing when we were first there was to have his own group, was to revive Roy's group. It turned out that he did, and one of the things that when we found out that he had his own clan over there, we were very fine with being, you know, the sister clan, you know, the sister coven. We didn't have an issue with that. The issue we had was when the gal running the sister the clan in England decided that since we were Americans, we weren't equal to her. That we were we were kind of the cadet branch, that we were the bastard children, you know, that we didn't have even though we had the bloodline, as it were, we weren't legal, you know, we weren't the legal heirs, and it was very much like the redheaded stepchild, you know, where you have the same daddy and you have the heritage, but you were a bastard and the other heirs are legitimate, and therefore they inherit it and you don't. You know, it was a kind of a that feel to it.
Yeah.
And that we could only be legitimate if we joined her clan and acknowledged her authority. And that we refused to do.
I don't blame you.
My contention was, in my emails to her, was we are either equal or we're not. I mean, this whole thing of there can be only one and it has to be a British clan. And you guys can be the cadet branch only if you acknowledge our authority. No, that we would not do. Now, I don't know if that came from John so much, although he later in his life he decided that he didn't like Americans and that his lineage, his official lineage, should go to a British couple rather than to us. I don't know what happened there. It apparently was common. The plant brand did that to Martha, if you remember, you know, that whole story, where it was decreed that traditional British witchcraft had to be British, that the Americans could be, part of it,
yeah,
but not running it, not the legitimate,
yeah,
heirs.
Yeah, you're getting a lot of, yeah.
And so that was the conflict. And we wanted to be her equal. I wanted to be her equal. I wanted to be her sister. I wanted to be her share the legitimacy. And that wasn't what she wanted to do. So that was the end of that. So
probably, in all probability, that was the end of her, and the end of her coven anyway. I don't imagine she's doing very well over there with it.
She
does
never
and,
had a coven. She never had,
yeah,
a group that actually,
yeah,
worked.
It's
she had
one of these people who is chartered on paper and she had she's a self-mythologizer who has an organization that doesn't exist except on paper and in her own mind. There's one thing, and I'm going to say that, and you're not saying that, I'm saying that. So if she doesn't like what I'm saying, she can deal with me. Anyway, one more thing I'd like to discuss before we sign off is the Menhir of St. Husek. Now, this is a 1734 issue. And as I told you, I said we've got a terrific MacGuffin, and in 1734 we got a terrific MacGuffin. And the MacGuffin is the Menhir of St. Husek. And this is a 2,500 B.C. granite standing stone in Brittany, in France, is you know, of the same time and style as Stonehenge. It's a great big standing stone, and it has some very, very interesting set of carvings on it, which are from a much later date. Is that you, Ann?
Yeah, I'm here.
I heard somebody, what? Somebody kind of mumbling.
No, I'm here. It was me.
Okay. What is, who is mumbling in the background?
I don't know.
Well, okay. So I'll continue. Anyway, this Menhir apparently excited Roy Bauer's interest, and he did an interpretation of it, and that ended up in the 1734 papers along with a big glossy photograph of it, and I was thinking that this was the MacGuffin of 1734. In case you people out there in Hermetic land don't know what a MacGuffin is, a MacGuffin is an object, is an object that sort of is the central object of a story, and And it's a Hollywood term, and the most famous Hollywood MacGuffin was the Maltese Falcon. And the Maltese Falcon, if you recall the film, it's just a black statue of a bird, which was said to have a whole bunch of jewels molded inside it, the Malta treasure, you know. Actually, it wasn't. It was just a black statue of a falcon. That was all it was. But the whole story revolved around it, and so that it was called a MacGuffin. Now the menhir of Saint Huzek, I was going to say was the MacGuffin of 1734. But I wanted to go ahead and go beyond Roy's interpretation of it, and do a little more research on it, which I did, and I did some translations from French, and this is what we came up with. The menhir is about 8 meters high and 3 meters wide. This makes it the largest menhir in France with Christian symbols. The sculpturing by the Jesuit priest and Breton orthographer Julien Manoir, 1666 to 1683, also known as the Apostle of Brittany, took place in 1674 as a decoration of war on the supposedly reviving paganism in Brittany. The redesigned menhir could be included as a station in the processions of the cross, and on top of it, he wears a crucifix in addition to the moon and the sun and the scenes of worship and the instruments of the Passion. The hammer, nails, whip, and others are carved into the south side. Now, these symbols, I can understand why Roy was interested in this, because these symbols, not only that they could be interpreted as Christian, they could also be interpreted as Mithraic or Hermetic. And on top of that, the man who sculpted them. Now, of course, the menhir itself is, the granite sandy stone was erected in 2500 BC, around the time of Stonehenge. But the man who sculpted it, the Jesuit priest, Julien Manoir, in the 1674, was later made a saint. A saint at this. Now, what is really weird about this, and I'm sure Roy probably realized this, is that Julien, J-U-L-I-E-N, is the French version of Julien, J-U-L-I-A-N, and the Emperor Julien around 400 A.D., the Roman Emperor Julien was called Julien the Apostate, and he was going to rip Christianity out of the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire had already gone Christian, you know, by that time, and the Emperor Julien was going to go back to paganism, back basically to Mithra. But, you know, all the symbols that this Julien Manoir, who is supposedly the Apostle of Brittany, who the Catholic Church sainted, carved into this menhir. This is the weirdest. This is a kind of a. It's an oxymoron. It's a conundrum. It's really amazing. I think this is why Roy latched onto it, and he realized that there was something about this guy, this Julien, who was hearkening back to the original emperor. The original Roman emperor who wanted to reject Christianity, and instead of that, Julien Manoir carves all these symbols on this pagan monolith, supposedly to make it Christian and not pagan. And then this whole thing is really weird. But anyway, as I said, the men here of San Husek, Saint Husek, this is the MacGuffin of 1734. Now, so at least the research was true. Anyway, and do you have any last words for us before we close out? Are you there?
I'm here. I'm trying to distill it down. One of the things that I talk about in the book is the getting back to your story on the men here is this constant conflict with the between the remnants of the pagan shamanic priesthood and the Catholic Church and the Christian Church, and that this was a constant source of problems, and that in a letter to Bill Gray, Roy says that his ancestors left the pagan clan to, as he put it, join Methodism for Sunday afternoons, which is basically they joined the Christians in order to fit in to the social and economic life of Britain at the time, and that was a constant problem, is that the people that kept to the old ways were almost pariahs. They were outcasts. And in order to get jobs and get you know, advantageous marriages and join guilds in the towns and make a living, you had to join the church. And in the case of the men here that you're talking about, this was well after the Protestant Reformation, which meant that if you joined the church, it wasn't the Catholic Church, it was the Anglican Church, it was the C of E. And it was, whether they believed in Christianity or not, they had to join the church in order to participate in the economic life of the village or the town or whatever it was. So you had this constant problem with the cunning folk, cunning men and cunning women who would be out there in the heath and doing spells and herbal healing and things like that. And the townspeople who were Christian and had been for 1,000 years, and this was actually more of a post-Protestant issue than it was a Catholic issue, because it involved economics. You know, if you wanted to get off the farm and go into the town and apprentice to a guild and make some money and have a house, all that stuff, and be a pillar of the community, you had to at least be nominally Christian. And that there was this uneasy truce between the shamanic practices and Protestant Christianity. Whether it was the same in Brittany, I don't know, but I suspect it was a similar issue, where you had to be, you know, you had to go to church in order to be considered a full citizen, prominent citizen. And you know, be able to sell your wares in the marketplace and all that.
Well,
so
you know, we know that in Haiti, everybody calls voodoo, is interlaced and interpenetrated with all kinds of Catholic symbolism. You know, if you go into a Vudan Humpho temple, you'll find pictures of saints, and they may have the veve of the Ogun drawn over the picture of the saint, or they may have it down the corner or something, but Santeria, of course, came, you know, the same way. It's interpenetrated with Catholicism, and Roman Catholicism is so kind of pagan anyway that it fits right in. But the symbols on the Julian carved on the old men here, these symbols are so obviously Mithraic, and you know we got that hammer. The hammer and nails, okay, that's supposedly to drive the hammer and drive the hammer to drive the nails in Christ, and the ladder to climb up the cross and all that. But all of these symbols, including Tubal Cain's tongs, and you know his forging tongs and all this, and the ladder of the planets, you know, the Mithraic ladder. Jacob, all of this stuff is all Mithraic, and Mithra, as we know, that's Mithra is actually the eastern version of Hermetic philosophy, which is the Western version of Mithra, and Sol Invictus, the Roman Sol Invictus, and all that. So, as I say. We're looking on the Sandusek men here. We're looking at one of these Vudan type interpenetrations between the church and paganism. I believe anyway.
Well, that doesn't explain why you have the broom and the distaff. I mean, one of the reasons why Roy used the men here as an illustration of the male and the female mysteries is that you have the female mysteries on the men here as well. You have the broom and the distaff and the spindle and all of the tools that a woman would use to cook and weave cloth and that kind of thing. So, and he used it as an illustration of both the craft mysteries and the female craft mysteries, which is basically your spindle and your distaff and all of that. Because where the women would spin. And spinning was considered a craft just as much as hammering nails was.
Yeah.
And that was it was considered magic. Folk tales talk about the fact that spinning, spinning gold is straw into gold and weaving the fate of people and nations and spinning the thread and then cutting it, you know, to symbolize the end of a life and the end of the three fates. So spinning and cloth making was the women's equivalent. And it was considered just as magical as the hammer and the tongs. So that was that was my reading of it anyway. And going back and reading Bauer's description of it, it seemed to be that was what he was using as an illustration of the craft, the idea of craft as being having both a male and a female side, which was the whole point.
You're right.
So
anyway, the I'm glad we brought it up because I really think that, you know, that we got some of our listeners, I'm sure, have been involved in 1734, or at least, they, or if not, they know somebody who has, and they know something about it. And we really couldn't, I really didn't think we could discuss 1734 without mentioning the men here. And so I'm glad we did. Anyway, and your insights are more profound than mine, as they usually are. And so
I just express them better.
Well, anyway, let's see. Next week, I believe we have a previous show on the James Branch Cabell fantasy novel Jurgen, which I strongly recommend every.
Join us today during the Jeep Celebration event, where right now, well-qualified lessees get an ultra-low mileage lease on the 2024 Jeep Wrangler Sport S4xe for $329 a month for 36 months with $3,960 due at signing. Tax, title, license extra. No security deposit required. Call 1-888-925-JEEP for details. Requires dealer contribution and lease through Stellantis Financial. Extra charge for miles over 15,000. Includes $7,500 EV cap cost reduction. Not all customers will qualify. Residency restrictions apply. Take retail delivery by 4-1. Jeep is a registered trademark.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.